Kia ora, I'm Maria. I'm Māori and Pakeha.
And I'm Kate, and I'm Iranian Australian.
And you're listening to Being Biracial.
It's the podcast all about navigating the world as a biracial person. We want to acknowledge that we're recording this podcast on the unceded sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nation.
We offer our respect to the elders of these lands, past, present, and those to come, and acknowledge the traditional custodians from the lands where this podcast is reaching you. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, we've changed our theme tune just for this episode because
today we're going to be interviewing Jen Kloa about being biracial.
Jen Kloa is Māori and Pakeha, more specifically Ngāpuhi and Ngāti Kahu. She is a songwriter and performer living on unceded Wurundjeri land here in Naarm, Melbourne. This is actually Jen's song, Mana Takatāpui, from their album I Am the River, The River Is Me. Jen joins us ahead of their solo Australia tour. Kia ora, Jen, how are you?
Kia ora, kōrua. I'm really well, thanks. Kei te pai aho.
I'm so excited to have you here because you're my mix. I'm giving it away.
So we always start off this podcast by asking, what's your mix?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was thinking about the title of this podcast being biracial. And I'm sure I'm not the first and I won't be the last to say that it would be a lie if I were to call myself simply biracial. I'm multiracial. On my mother's side, my matrilineal side, I am Māori, just like my whanaunga here. And that's a really beautiful and important line for me because it's my mother, Dorothy Ehrlich Kloa, my grandmother, Huriata Puata, and my great-grandmother, Marara Puata. So I think when you come through a line where, you know, it's a matrilineal line, it's unbroken, there is a sense, I guess, of responsibility in carrying forward that culture. And it's a culture that I'm very proud of. It's a culture that I've really only been, I guess, seriously reconnecting with over the last 5 or 6 years. And I think in a way, reflecting on that, I needed to be ready, I think. You know, it's a big undertaking for anyone listening. You'll know, you'll understand when we make that decision, you do step into that world. On my grandfather, who married Huriata Puata, my mother's grandfather, our father, my grandfather, is Jim Ehrlich and Ivan James Ehrlich, but known as Jim Ehrlich. And Jim was a settler who came from Croatia. And then on my dad's side, he is third generation Irish settler. And that's a patrilineal line. My dad, his dad, his granddad, and on it goes. Idahi, Irish, and he married my grandmother who had, I think, a mix there of German and perhaps British. So there's a lot of lineage that comes through. I am very proud, though, I have to say, having Irish and Māori, particularly at this sort of time in the world, I think, where really seeing how much mana, you know, how much power people are stepping up from, you know, Indigenous cultures to speak to, you know, colonisation and the effects, ongoing effects of colonisation. So, yeah, I mean, that's me, really. That's my mix.
It's not as simple as being like, oh, yeah, so my mum is this and my dad is this, because it goes back and back and back and back and back. Mm. Like, yeah.
I think that the really important thing about knowing who we are and where we come from, particularly as settlers, you know, to be able to locate myself within the colony and speak to the fact that we are in a colony, you know, it's really important, I think, when I pay my respects to elders, past and present, and to the people of this land. I think part of that respect is having taken the time to know, you know, where did I come from? How did I come to be here? And what has been the impact that myself and my family members have had on these lands? And I think until we have right relations, so that would look like a treaty perhaps, I think, you know, until that work is done, we never really live on these lands in a truly honourable way. And you know, I think podcasts like this and conversations like this really help us all to kind of have a think about that. And, you know, all of that said, I knew about these mixtures growing up because you hear about, you know, the old land or the wherever the marae, or, you know, you hear those stories from your parents. But it's another thing to engage with it as an adult and to really think about it. And I think that's why I've really walked toward particularly my matrilineal language and culture being so close, so nearby, so living. The revitalization that's happened for Māori in the last 40 years has been quite something. And I think it's rubbed off on a lot of whānau over here into whenua moi moia, or so-called Australia.
So how you grew up here? Did you grow up here?
I did, yeah. I was actually born here in Naam, and then I grew up on Kaurna land in Adelaide, and then I spent about 10 years on Gadigal land in Sydney. And then I came back to Naam, and I've been here now for about 20 years. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. And how did you – I think you've spoken about it a little bit already, but did you have a sense of your Māori identity being raised away from Aotearoa?
It was something I knew about, and it was something that I always felt a sense of pride. You know, when my mother spoke, she'd be like, "You're a Māori princess," you know. I think we all heard that.
Yeah.
But you know, to some extent, she was right. You know, my mother's no longer alive. She passed along with my dad. They actually died within 3 months of each other in 2011. So I speak of them as though they are still here and living, because in many ways they are. And that relationship, even though it's not in the phys, in the physical, I definitely feel it.
Did you just hear that?
Yes.
Old-timey train.
I was like, when did that happen?
Puffing Billy.
But yes, to come back to the Māori side, my mother told me I was a Māori princess, but as it turns out, my great-grandmother, Marara, her father was Tupe, and Tupe was the rangatira, or the chief of our hapu, you know, so our sub-tribe. And this is all stuff that I'm really kind of learning about now. So, you know, there was a sense, but I think, you know, when I'd go back home to Aotearoa and meet whānau, for a start, I'm fair-skinned. And I'm growing up without any whānau around, no language, no culture, not even the food culture really, except my mother's voracious love for seafood. Mm. And I think I just couldn't really connect how we were related. Like, you don't really look like me, or I don't look like you. You know, your culture is really different to the one that I'm experiencing back in Adelaide. It took me a really long time to go, no, it's more than just those things that make you part of culture.
So was there a particular turning point? Like you said, about 5 years ago or so, you started trying to connect more with that part of yourself. What happened?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, like a long time coming. And I think there was a real sense that I was probably going to open this door at some point, but my life had been just so fast and busy. And, you know, I was running a record label, I was touring, you know, here and overseas, and I was running, you know, workshops for a decade, you know, for self-managed artists. I was like, really, I think from about the age of 35 to 45, I actually can't work out how I fit it all in. When COVID hit, I was like, I used to run. I used to run out of the house, into the house, to the room. Like I'd never, I was living life so fast that I was literally running from room to room for about a decade. And you're like, whoa.
How?
So fast. And I was packing it in. Like, you know, I'd be working nights and days. People think you're just sitting around writing songs and like having fun with your record label, and you're like diligently up until midnight, like putting someone's album up on Bandcamp or whatever. So yeah, it was a packed time, and I think it wasn't really until things slowed down a little bit, I stepped away from the label, that I think there was some space and some room. And I took a trip home to Aotearoa to tour with a band called Tiny Ruins, some friends of mine who are also on Milk Records. And yeah, I think on that tour I was like, I'm going to go out to my marae. And I hadn't visited since I'd been up there, probably like 10 years before, maybe even longer with my mum. And so, yeah, it was kind of that trip back to, they were having a big clean up at the Urupa, the cemetery across the road from the marae, the meeting house. And I just had those awkward moments, that you hear so many Māori, even Māori that grow up in Aotearoa who grow up in the city. Yeah, they go back to the marae and they go, oh my God, I don't know any of the tikanga, any of the customs, and, you know, I don't really understand what's expected of me in this space, and I feel like a fraud. And that all of that stuff happened for me, and I just thought, oh, what's happened? You know, how has this happened? And let's do some work to try and reconnect in some way. So that's kind of really what I've been doing for the last 5 years.
It's a big move going to the marae,
mm-hmm.
especially without mum.
That's it. And I think that's what this whole part of my life has been about, is being brave enough to step into that space of going, you know, I have a right to be here. I'm not going to suck all of the air out or extract from whānau. I really want to be able to bring something. And I think as well, the reason why I've been learning te reo, the Māori language, and going to different, kaupapa, different sort of schools, from Modako, which is a Māori martial arts, to a bit of kapa haka here and there, to language, te reo Māori language classes here in Nam, is so that when I do go home, they're not having to do that heavy lifting of going, oh, here's the fragile, fair-skinned one from Melbourne, who's going to freak out. You know, it's like the beautiful, actually really beautiful thing that happened was our marae was rebuilt because there was flooding. So the marae that I visited in 2019 was demolished, and they slowly over the last few years rebuilt the marae, and I went back for the opening, the reopening, and it was something my mother had definitely been very much, you know, encouraging of that happening in her lifetime. And it was actually one of her nephews who was the architect who helped design the marae with the, I guess, three different hapū that work from that marae. And so prior to the big opening, which was a whole event in itself, some of my whānau were meeting in Tāmaki Makaurau in Auckland for kapa haka, so that we could have, you know, lots of great waiata and haka and all of those good things happening on the day of the opening. And I went along to one of the practice sessions, and, you know, again, just walking in, no one knows who you are. You're just walking up, oh, kia ora, you know, like we're related in this, you know, and here I am. And it's always a bit awkward, and people kind of giving you a bit of a side eye, like, who's this one? I've never seen them before. And then we kind of moved into a marae. It was like obviously not our marae, but one in Tāmaki Makaurau that one of our whānau also had hapū affiliations with. And the beautiful thing this time was I understood things that were happening, why they were happening, the general outline of what was being said, I knew some of the Karakia, and I knew some of the Waiata, and I could just join in. And all of that, like, am I enough? Oh, I don't look like everyone. Like all of that self-conscious, I call it the colonized critical parent. It wasn't there. And you could feel people going, ah, oh, this one's, you know, like they're here and they're a part of and awesome. And so by the end of the day, you know, I'd had some kōrero. I knew to bring some kai. I knew to bring some koha, you know, just a bit of money to put in the envelope. Those basic things, learning those things has really helped me to feel a lot more grounded in all of that stuff around like, well, do I have the right and, you know, should I be doing this? And, you know, all of those weird imposter syndrome things that can pop up for us when we're mixed.
The CCP, the, what is it,
colonized critical parent.
I got a CCP sitting on my shoulder and the CCP is saying, you're not enough, don't go to me.
I was wondering if you could just describe like what a marae actually is for people that don't have a concept like
yeah.
me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess like a marae is quite a few buildings actually. We kind of refer to marae and you think of one building, but there's the whare tupuna, which is often where you have, you know, photos of your ancestors and you might have formal meetings in there. You might have tangihanga, which are funeral ceremonies. You have the whare kai, where you can have a feed. That's kind of the basic outline. There might be a few other little buildings, maybe a shower block or two. And the beautiful thing about marae is, you know, there's a real tradition of sleeping in the marae as a whole whānau, and you just pull out the mattresses and everyone sets up their bedding and there's always a few cousins that snore and you don't have the best sleeps at the marae. Some people sleep really well there, some people don't. But, you know, this is something that I wish, you know, I had experienced, but, you know, speaking to some of my elders, kaumātua, who live out that way and have been, you know, going along to wānanga, which are a kind of, I guess, like long discussions and learning. They talk about sitting up in the marae till all hours, hearing their elders, their kaumātua, telling all of the stories of the old days. And I love that idea of sitting and learning in that way, learning in the way of stories that are yours, you know, they're stories that you are related to. And I think that's the thing that's really been so amazing about reconnecting is learning a language and going, oh, this has cultural significance. It's not me going and learning French or Italian and then going to France and Italy and going, wow, look at me, I'm speaking. You know, it's a language that was once spoken in my whānau. It only took a generation to be lost. But I'm really committed to learning the reo to the best of my ability and in whatever way I can, you know, supporting, encouraging other members of my whānau to do the same or just joining them on that journey.
In my family, I'm the generation that Te Reo Māori was lost on, and I didn't know that my dad spoke Te Reo Māori until he was singing a herb song in the car when I was 23. And I was like, hey, what's going on? And he was like, yeah. So it was my first language, and I was like, why don't I know this? But he had a really hectic upbringing, so he wanted to protect me from that, and the way that he sought to protect me from it was to cut us off from it. Mm. And so I expressed to him maybe in the last couple of years that I wanted to go to our marae, and he was like, don't go there. Mm. And I was like, that's your mai, that's your pain. Mm. That's not my pain, and I'm a fully grown adult who can go back there and, you know, navigate the space on my own. I don't need you to be there with me. I would love it if he came with me, but it sounds like his pain is too great for him to carry it on.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think those stories are really important, you know, like hearing everyone has all different reasons for maybe why they don't want to go back home, or maybe they don't want to go back onto their marae. It's not necessarily a place of joy and good memories. But yeah, I think, you know, I support you in that. And I think that, yeah, whānau is so much bigger even than our immediate family. And the ones that I've connected with are, you know, like cousins, you know. They're not even like direct auntie kind of energy, you know. They're sort of like, I think one of my kaumātua, all right, just do some mental gymnastics here. So my grandmother's brother had kids, and then their kids, right? And so she's 86, and she's like a kind of cousin a few times removed, or if that makes sense. But you know, like, I think the thing that is beautiful about certainly Māori culture is we don't really look at whānau in that way. It's just like, you're whānau and she's an auntie to me. And that's all that needs to be known. And she's definitely an auntie to me in the fact that Meri Muka is her name, in the fact that she holds so much of our whānau's knowledge. And she is always the one when I go back home that I'll go and sit with for a few hours and usually push record, because I want to make sure that her stories are heard.
Do you find that in learning and, like, you know, coming back to being Māori, that you're finding a lot of your traits that you had that you might have thought were just your own are actually, like, really Māori traits?
Yeah, I mean, I think, interestingly, I don't necessarily think it's so much in my gestures or the way I laugh or move, but definitely things like, I love kai, I love food, I'm obsessed with food, I'm a feeder. That manaaki, that manaaki is to take care of, you know, manaaki tanga, where, yeah, if anyone steps into your whare, into your house, you want to make sure they're taken care of, they've got enough kai, they've got a good, you know, drink that they're happy with, that they're comfortable. And also having a whare, a house that feels warm and, you know, somewhere that feels welcoming. And I think those things really, my mother didn't have the reo, the language, but what was transmitted were those values. And I think that's the other thing that's really beautiful to remember is culture and language. There are so many more languages than the one that we speak. And, you know, I think that my mother was teaching me another language, which was, this is how we do things, this is how we value people, you value elders, you know, you're respectful. So yeah, I think that's the stuff that I really identify with more than going, whoa. But that said, actually, and this is an interesting one, when I was back up north for our opening, for the marae opening, I went up with two of my first cousins. So yeah, my mother's nieces, and one of them's actually named after my mother, Dorothy. So Dorothy and Teresa. And when I was sitting with them having a kai after the big opening, and I mean, this is the other thing, right? This was next level. So they managed to feed 1,000 people in, I think, 2 hours.
Ooh.
Right? And you had like aunties walking around with just trays of fresh oysters, crayfish. Because it's all about, you know, having the best seafood.
What if you're up north, the kai moanas.
Kai moana, aye. And there were, everyone got a hangi pack and dessert, you know, like the full thing, yeah. And you were like, only Māori can organise in that way. Mm-hmm. Where everyone's fed, everyone was parked, and we started on time, you know, like – Maybe that isn't necessarily a Māori trait, but certainly our whānau. And I've lost my train of thought, so you need to bring me back in again here.
You were talking about, like, what traits of yours?
Yeah. Traits, manaaki. Oh, yeah, so it is important. I'm glad we came back. So when we were having this kai, see, I'm obsessed with food. I got totally lost in the food. And then I was like, what else is there? What were we talking about? Watching my cousins just eating and laughing, I was like, whoa, I really saw my mother in their faces and in their gestures and ways that they were doing things. And my their father, Victor, my uncle, and my mum, Dorothy, were closest together in age, and they were really close. So they would have grown up together and shared a lot of space together. So seeing those things, I was like, oh, this is really special, because I don't have siblings. Mm. So it was quite a special thing, and they're kind of similar age to me, you know, late 40s into their 50s. And I was like, oh, this is really beautiful, and I'm so glad that I got to share that experience with them, because they're on their own journey as well of reconnecting. Hey, I know I still got a way to go, but I think I see Aroha, mana takata pui, ke roto I a koe.
So in, like, your career as a musician, is this journey that you've been going on, like reconnecting with your Māori heritage, I feel like that's reflected in the way that your music has kind of progressed over the last few albums and EPs. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was definitely not anything that I set out to do. And, you know, if you had asked me even, I reckon, yeah, 4 years ago, you know, when I started to write songs for this record, if you'd said to me, oh, do you think, you know, there might be some, you know, Māori words in this album, and it might be about being, you know, reconnecting with your matrilineal lineage, and maybe you'll write a, you know, get some help in writing your first ever waiata Māori, I would have been like, no, that is not why, you know, like I just would not have seen that as something that was possible. And I sort of started to slowly learn a bit of the language, went to a few online courses as we do initially. COVID was happening, so that was kind of how a lot of people were learning. I went out to a few kapa haka classes in Cranbourne with Te Hononga o Ngā Iwi, who ended up performing on my album and then going out on the road with me. But, yeah, I think, you know, words started to creep into my songs, and initially I was really frightened of that. I was like, oh, I don't know if I feel comfortable with this. I don't know if I have the authority or the right. You know, I just don't know enough. But I just kept going, because I was like, well, I generally write about the things that mean the most to me, that the stuff that's really happening and alive for me at that time. And that was what was going on, and I couldn't avoid it. And so I think it was just that thing of stepping into the deep end and just taking a risk and going, look, I might get absolutely, you know, like cancelled for doing this. I don't know, but I'm just going to do it and find out. And actually, you know, none of those things that I thought would happen happened. I was pulled up on a few things, and I think, you know, rightly so, and I don't know everything, and that's part of the learning. And I think, you know, it's still a lesson that I'm trying to learn, is like, if people come and tell you something about what you've done that maybe isn't quite right, to listen and just be like, oh, awesome, you know, thank you. Thank you for actually caring enough to take the time to communicate that to me. And that's the thing, you know, there could be a lot of people who are like real pissed off with me that I'll never know. They're like, bloody album. So, yeah, but I think the general feeling anyway when I've played shows, I've had a lot of Māori come up to me afterward and tell me how a certain song or lyric or their own journey of reconnecting and the other things that I've made alongside it, like the podcast and whatever, you know, there's, I think, 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 Māori live here in Australia. So there's a lot of us here who know that we're Māori, some of us don't, and, you know, we're looking for things that can help us because it's, you know, for anyone listening, and certainly I would imagine for both of you, it's really painful. It's really painful work to set out on making the decision to, you know, take that risk because what you're stepping toward is something that you want. You know, you do want the love and approval of your people, of your whānau, of feeling a part of being accepted. Of course there's that, you know, it's human, you know. And so there's a lot at stake, you know. You don't want to get things wrong. You don't want to break anything. So, yeah, I think it's, yeah, it's just been it's been big, you know, and there's been some really scary and you know, challenging times as well as beautiful moments of celebration, yeah.
And I think it's it happens a lot, the like Māori, other Māori people coming in and correcting you if you've done or said something wrong. And I think you hit it on the head there that it comes from a place of care. And sometimes it can come across pretty mean. I've been shamed a lot for a lot of different things. But at the end of the day, it is about, you know, care and, you know, bringing people into the fold. Sometimes it's abrasive, but it's just how Māori are.
Yeah, you know, I think that, I mean, I can't really speak, you know, for those outside of my own whānau. I've been lucky, you know, like I've had some really generous and kind and gentle people, but I'm sure the brisk, slightly abrasive, you know, aunties and uncles are coming.
They always are.
Yeah, they'll show up for sure. And I think the great thing is when they do, like I said before, I've done a bit of work to be able to unpack it and understand where it's coming from, and I think also, you know, show them that I'm on this, you know, I genuinely want to be a part of this. I'm not really there for anything except to know more and to open the door for others in my whānau, you know. Yeah.
And I think it's like with this podcast, for instance, and I feel like it kind of mirrors onto this album for you and your experience in creating this album. We kind of think about it as like a little capsule of this particular moment. Like, this is us at this time. It doesn't have to be the manifesto, you know, and all of your knowledge in one piece of art or something that you've created. It's just us at this particular moment, and you're kind of leading with vulnerability and care. And so that's the point of connection. And yeah, I think that feels really special for people, and that's why it probably resonates.
Yeah, I really love that take, and I think it's really true. It's, you know, when you read the lyrics or listen to the album, I'm only coming from my own experience. I'm not speaking for everyone, and I'm speaking to the experience of being diasporic, and, you know, I name, you know, my whole, you know, life journey here on these lands and my connections back home in a song called Being Human. Yeah, so I think that's the thing is, you know, I'm really just coming from my own identity, my own experience. And I think generally speaking, you can't do too much harm if that's your approach.
I love what you've said about how the lyrics just crept in, like the Māori words just crept into your writing process, which I think is especially funny because it's named after a whakatauke. Like,
yeah.
There's so many proverbs in your album and in all the lyrics. Can you tell us the whakatauke of your album.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is really, this was a great example of a journey of learning. You know, I'm not sure exactly how I came across Ko'o Te Awa, Ko'o Te Awa, Ko'o. I am the river is me, but it came into my world and I started to read about its connection to Whanganui Iwi, so tribes from Whanganui or Whanganui, and a legislation that was passed in 2017 that was landmark where they were able to win legal personhood for their awa, for their river. And that legislation has had a huge influence all around the world with Indigenous people. And it, obviously, if you assign the rights of personhood, you can't harm and extract and do things to that body of water. I mean, you know, an awa has a mouth and a body. And so, yeah, I think that I just saw it as such a beautiful way of thinking about this moment that we find ourselves in today, where we're really looking down the barrel of, you know, are we able to take care of this planet? And the beautiful thing about Māori culture is how we are so connected to, you know, when we introduce ourselves, when we meet someone else, the first thing we tell them is, you know, this is the waka, this is the canoe that my ancestors came in on, and, you know, this is my mountain, my maunga, and this is my river, my awa, and then it goes from there. You know, these are my tribes, this is my sub-tribe. But I didn't know, and it was only until I was pulled up by mokopuna, of Koro John Rangatihi Tahupurai. And it's actually, I found out, not a whakatauhi, but a whakatauaki. And a whakatauaki means we know who spoke these words, and a whakatauhi is we don't know exactly who spoke these words, but this is a saying. And you can often know maybe tribally where it is sourced from. But it's actually a whakatauaki. And I didn't know this, and they let me know in quite a straightforward manner. and this was actually a moment, you know, where I learnt, because I reacted and I got upset and I felt like they were having a go, and I learned a really big lesson from that exchange, and I was able to, you know, come back and apologise and say, you know, I think I really overreacted there. I'm really sorry, and, you know, thank you for letting me know this. And I will make sure, you know, moving forward, that whenever I speak to this, that I mention your koro and your iwi's connection to this whakatauaki. And I think, you know, if I were to, you know, what I know now, were I to use a whakatauaki or a whakatauki that comes from a different tribal group, even my own tribal group, I would go to komatua or people in that tribal group and let them know what my intentions are, let them know what I'm doing, and ask them, you know, how do you feel about this whakatauaki being used as the title of my album? Because I think what people can think when that exchange doesn't happen is that, oh, this person is just extracting from my culture, making it into an album and then selling it, and they're making money out of my culture, and that is extraction. And really that was the furthest thing from my mind. But yeah, it's this is stuff that is really good to talk about, because it can be a real curveball. And I think what I've really come to understand is why so many people don't walk toward their culture, why it's so scary and overwhelming. Because if you were really early on and you got that message, it could have closed a door, you know, and that person wasn't to know, you know, because maybe from what I could see, they've grown up on their whenua with their reo, with their tikanga, knowing these stories, knowing their koro, having all of that connection, and they don't understand that, you know, you stand on a really different side of that coin. And I think, you know, that's some of the work that is being done and hopefully continues to be done, is bridging that gap so that people can understand we're all coming from really different places. We're all walking up the same mountain, you know, but there's different challenges on the way up. The view from the top is the same. That's the hope, you know, but it is a different path for everyone, and really respecting that. And I think one of the most beautiful things, you know, today I was at Te Reo Maioha, which is language classes that happen here in Nam. In person, there's probably about, I don't know, 60 people who are part of this kura, this school, and it's Te Ātaharangi, which is a school that was started around the time of the Kōhanga Reo movement, so I think sort of around the 80s. And, you know, the beautiful thing about this form of learning is that we use these coloured rods. They're called cuisinaire rods. We call them rākau, which is the word for wood. And you learn with these rākau. You're not in the book. There's lots of waiata singing. And it's a really beautiful interactive sitting together and speaking together. And the reason why this way of learning came to be was that all of these amazing nannies, probably, you know, some of yours and mine, yeah, Ehua, you know, they came together and they were like, we're going to make these Kōhanga Reo language nests for our babies, because we can see that this language is being lost. And if we don't do something, because the government isn't going to do anything about it, if we don't start to build these language nests around Aotearoa, then, you know, it could be lost. And so it was brought into kindergarten, Kōhanga Reo kindergarten, and then kura kaupapa, so into, you know, primary and secondary school. And so a lot of these young, you know, kids were learning Māori at school. And they'd come home though, and maybe their koro or their kuia, their grandma or grandpa, they were part of that generation who were beaten for speaking the language, so they don't speak it. And Te Ātaharangi came from that desire to make sure that the elders could speak the reo back to the kids, to the tamariki. And that's a beautiful thing, is like from both ends, you know, from the elders to the babies, is bringing the reo back so that we can have that intergenerational transmission. So, yeah, it's been amazing learning that way, because it's so gentle, because I think what Te Ātaharangi understands is the trauma, of people coming to a language later in life because they were forbidden, or their parents were forbidden, or their grandparents were forbidden. And when you think about the violence of having a language ripped out of someone's body, not being able to speak your identity — our language is how we identify, right? It's how we relate. That is a deep trauma. And, you know, even though that wasn't my direct experience, it's been really interesting to see how I can just freeze up and start sweating and all of this stuff starts happening, which I do not think would happen if I was learning Spanish, for example. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, hard out, yeah.
You know, it's like I don't have trauma around speaking Spanish, but here I am learning this language, and you're like, oh, this is what they mean about intergenerational trauma, is it is felt, you know, and it does come through lines. And the beautiful thing for us is that we get to do the healing. We get to bring these stories and our language and, you know, our practices back. And one other thing I just wanted to add to that, which I think is so beautiful, is this idea that nothing is lost, that we can bring it back in. Even if it's not necessarily I don't know, there's just something about practicing something where it bubbles up and it comes through in all of these different ways, and just staying open, you know, to that journey, that Haerdinger.
And it's practicing because there's not a destination, there's not an end point for it. Yeah.
That's it.
It's continual learning.
That's it.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because while you've been talking, I've been thinking about the fact that, like, you've been going through this reclamation kind of journey, and you've been doing it in a way that is, like, authentic to you as a person in this world. And that's so, like, that's so special in so many ways. And I think it's something that we've talked a lot about. And it obviously my context is so different, but like, for me going to Iran, I had to do that without my mum because she's not able to go back to Iran. And so there's like a sadness that comes from doing that alone, but there's also like something so rich and beautiful that then I get to recreate my Persian identity myself in a way, and that it's my journey and distinctly Kate. And I've just been hearing a lot of that in what you've been saying, which is really nice.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah, I mean, that's heartbreaking that your mum, you know, can't go back. But yeah, it is a beautiful thing to think that you can go and have that experience, and you can hear those stories and bring those stories home. I think the thing that you touch on there, it's really cool. I was like driving out this morning with one of my nieces and who goes to Te Reo Maioha with me, and this. Just over the last week, I've been listening to a playlist that I put together because I have there's a ropu, a group of us that get together on Tuesday nights. It's Takatāpui Tuesday. And it's any Māori who identify as being, you know, queer, whatever that looks like for you. And we just get together at a local hall and we learn a waiata, you know. And it's just something we do together. Anyone who's Takatāpui in Nam, come through.
I will see you next Tuesday.
Aye. And it's been so beautiful because, you know, it's just a safe space. I think, you know, there's a lot of Takatāpui here. Often we can feel some of the spaces that we step into are quite gendered, and we maybe don't fully align ourselves with those roles, or there'll be a bit of me that identifies with that, but then I also identify with this and those nuances. And so this is a space, I think, where we just wanted to create a space that was really safe, that you could come along, and we were just going to do something really simple, which is we learn a song in our language. It's not about being a good singer, trust me. And it's not about going out and performing and becoming some Māori choir. Like, there's plenty of people who are way further down the path who have got that. Absolutely, they're off to bloody Matatini next week or something. Yeah, so we're not, don't you worry. Very early days. But, yeah, I think that that point you were making about, you know, your journey and what that looks like, I've been listening to this playlist that has some of the waiata that we're learning for Takatāpui Tuesdays, and when that playlist finishes, you know how Spotify will just start. And I've been hearing this beautiful folk music, and I'd heard their name before, but I'd never really listened to their music, by Hirini Melbourne. And Hirini is Tūhoe, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, Tūhoe. I got my niece this morning to read out about, you know, Hirini, and sadly they've passed on. I think they passed in 2003, but they were instrumental, like, in learning some of our traditional instruments, taonga puoro, and also composing waiata Māori. But what I loved about hearing this was it was folk. They were playing folk music and finger picking and singing in a way that is actually really close to the way I sing. And I think what I've realized is that, like, actually there's room for everyone. And, you know, just because perhaps reggae and dub and, you know, I guess like rhythm and blues, hip hop have had a big influence on Māori it's not the only way that we communicate. And sometimes I'd be like, oh, but I'm not making music like this person, and that's more of a Māori expression, and, you know, maybe a lot more Māori listen to that because that's what's popular, you know. But it was beautiful to hear this person, Hirini, who was doing something that feels very connected and, you know, their tikanga, beautiful reo, but folk, you know. I was like, this is cool, you know. So I'm going on a big Hirini Melbourne, trip at the moment.
Oh, I love that so much. Well, it's like Marlon Williams sings in Te Reo Māori, and he's got a big crooner voice. Like hearing him sing in Te Reo Māori, I love it.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I mean, it's such a beautiful language to sing in. And it makes so much sense because of those big open vowel sounds, Te Ao Māori, Māori, you know, like it's made to sing. And I think that's the beautiful thing, is like I love singing in my language, and I'm so glad that I didn't miss out, you know, that I was actually able to walk through all of the fear, because actually what's on the other side is so worth it. Yeah.
And I think you sing beautifully in Te Reo Māori, and it's your style as well. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it would be weird if I released like some reggae album. Be like, what happened to Jen Chloe?
Jen Chloe really took it sideways.
It's just like some dub reggae trip hop record or something. You'd be like, whoa. But, you know, and I think that's a beautiful thing about Marlon's work is I'm pretty sure he's just recorded a Te Reo Māori album, which is really exciting. But, yeah, when you hear him sing in his language, but in his way, and you're like, that is so Māori. That is so Māori when you sing, because you know what? You're Māori.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you're singing in your language, so that's Māori. You know, there's no definition of that.
Now, you have a song on the album. It's my favourite, Mana Takatāpui.
Hey,
I love it so much. And the video is awesome too. How important is it for you to identify as Takatāpui?
Well, I mean, I think that I've always been pretty openly queer. I think when I first came into the music industry in this country, it was not spoken about, you know. So I've been doing this for 25 years. It was, you know, there weren't a whole lot of people being out and proud, and, you know, I think it was something that was very obvious. If you listen to the lyrics on my first album, they're so gay. And if you were to look at any photos of me, it was easy to see that I was clearly a big gaylord. But I think the open conversation around it didn't feel safe. And that's really changed. Even in the last 10 years, I think there's been a huge shift, and it's like cool to be queer now, which I'm here for. But it was actually when I was learning more about, you know, my language and my culture, I was like, I wonder if there's a Māori word for queer. And so I typed it into Google, and sure enough, this word came up, Takatāpui, and I was like, wow, that's a cool word. And I did a little bit of kind of, you know, learning and listening and finding out, and it was actually Professor Nahuia Awakotoku, who is still here, very much so. I'd say would be probably late 70s, early 80s, I'm not sure. But she, you know, big lesbian feminist Māori, and you know, activist, and she brought that word back into circulation. I think it would have been late 70s into the 80s, which is, that's an example. Like, she brought something back into consciousness, and then when it was there, people ran with it. And that's a beautiful example of how we can bring things that might have been lost. And Takatāpui, when you look it up in the dictionary, means a close friend of the same gender, which I think is hilarious.
They're lesbians, Stacey. Yeah.
It's a close friend of the same gender. But I think what it's actually come to represent now is like LGBTQI+. And then obviously within that there are like whakawahine and like, you know, ways of speaking to particular identities, but takatāpu is the sort of umbrella term. And what I love about this word is that it speaks to the fluidity of my gender, of my sexuality and of my culture, you know, because there's fluidity there as well. You know, there's a lot that we can't easily define, you know. And I think that when we free ourselves with beautiful words like takatāpui, it frees everyone, you know. And I think that's what we've all started to learn is like, you know, binaries imprison everyone, you know. And when we can loosen up and see that life is fluid and time is fluid and nature is fluid and constantly moving and changing, then it makes real sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I love it too. The mouthfeel of the word too is just great.
Well, yeah, well, takatāpui mana is the Māori word for, I guess, like, you know, someone walk into a room and you notice them and or they stand up on the pai pai and there's a whai korero and they have a way of speaking or a way of being that feels solid and like they're sort of ancestral power coming through your strength. So Mana Takatāpui, that song and the video clip, which is full of iconic Takatāpui people, mm-hmm. Is about restoring the mana of our people and restoring the mana of that word and not, you know, pushing anyone out to the side. And, you know, there's been a lot of crazy shit going on back in Aotearoa, you know, with really mixed up, you know, crews, you know, sadly many Māori who have been, you know, acting out in some really transphobic ways. It's colonised religions that have done this terrible damage to our people, and I think it's remembering, you know, that before colonisation, I mean, we'll never really know, but I don't think that our people had these, you know, really hardcore defined gender roles, and if you stepped over the line, you were thrown out. Like, we just don't do that to whānau.
And I have, like, learned about in the course of when I was at uni, I had to read some, like, fucking Pākehā journals, like settler journals, where they talk about the peculiar gender roles of the native peoples, where it like talks about how the fathers used to carry children around on their back and, you know, be really involved in the parenting and how there would be, you know, like kind of queer expressions in within the people. But like they're looking at it through like an anthropological lens or like a lens of colonization, to be honest, and looking at how that's different and how to assimilate the natives into, you know, this project that they're doing. So there's precedents for it, pre-colonial, you know, ways of being that aren't as gendered as we might find ourselves now.
Totally. And I think, you know, people, those stories have been carried through and, you know, in different iwi, there are stories, you know, about men being midwives, being really hands-on, you know. I don't know if that's, you know, across the board, but there's research that's been done by our people and it is, you know, the beautiful thing about the research that's been done by our people is we go and speak to our elders. We go and speak to the knowledge keepers, the ones who have carried the stories. And, you know, it's an oral tradition and it's an oral history. We didn't need to write things in books, you know. We trusted that our knowledge and our language would be stored in bodies, you know, and what's safer. And something that's beautiful that one of my dear friends, Leah Arvanet, speaks about is, you know, they buried their treasure in us. You know, our ancestors knew that there were risks, that there were, you know, things that were outside of our control. And they buried taonga, treasures inside of us. And I love that image because, you know, when we unlock those treasures, when we have those moments where we remember who we are, it's healing And it's a gift that we can offer to others, you know, on their way home.
Mm. I think that's how we have to end.
Yes, I thank you, Jen, for being so generous with your kōrero today. It's been gorgeous to chat to you. I was a little bit intimidated before I came along because my CCP was sitting on my shoulder being like, girl, do you really think you can do this? But you've been so welcoming, and thank you so much for welcoming us into your home.
It's such a pleasure to have you here as manuhiri, as guests in my whare, in my house. And, yeah, I think that's the thing, eh, is like just anyone listening out there, just keep walking toward when the colonized critical parent gets on your shoulder and starts telling you, you know, just thank them and turn to that voice inside, that desire inside that needs, you know, because that's what our ancestors want. They don't want us to go, oh, nah, I don't want to know anything about who I am. They would want us, our tūpuna would want us to be having this kōrero, to be learning, you know, about this beautiful, rich language and culture that is ours, you know. Mm. And the thing I always remember, the last thing, I think this is a really beautiful way of looking at it, is like, you know, when people talk about blood quantums or full-blooded this or whatever, that weird kind of speak, not understanding what colonization is and how that impacts Indigenous cultures, I always think, you know, would my ancestors look at me and go, nah, you're not really related to me. Yeah, nah. Because this person married that person and they married them, I don't know, we're just not related anymore. I'm sorry, you're cancelled. You know, they don't look at us in that way. I know that my tūpuna look at me and are so proud, and they want me to carry, you know, carry this forward.
Jen, do you have anything to plug before we let you go?
Yeah, I will be touring around, playing some shows here in Te Whenua Moemoea, Ahitereia, so-called Australia. Just jump on my website, jenkloa.com, would you believe? and there's shows up there, yeah.
Gorge. Jen also has an album that has come out a wee while ago, but it's gorgeous. I Am the River Is Me. And the podcast, Everybody's Trying to Find Their Way Home, is also beautiful. Check it out.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Being Biracial.
This podcast is hosted, edited and produced by us, Kate Robinson and Maria Birch-Moringer.
And it was recorded and edited here on the lands of the Kulin Nation.
The music that you are hearing today is not the Green Twins. We still love them and they are still our theme tune. But the music that you are hearing is from Jen Kloa. It's from her album and it is the song Mana Taka Tāpui. Very special, and we're really thankful that Jen let us use the song.
Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.